Death to life. You could say, I was once blind, but now I can see. You could say, I used to be God's enemy, even if I wasn't aware of it. But I have found peace with him through Jesus Christ. All those images are very helpful. They're all taken from Scripture. The beginning of chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians gives us a different one, where Paul says that becoming a Christian is like getting engaged. It's becoming engaged to be married to Jesus Christ. He says in verse 2, I betrothed you to one husband to present you as a pure virgin to Christ. He speaks as a matchmaker. And what he has in mind, of course, is the great wedding day of the future, the climax of history, the promised return of Christ to claim his faithful people waiting for him, just as a groom is united with his bride on the day of their wedding. So if you're a Christian, you are engaged to be married. That's a wonderful thing to know. It's a rather exhilarating thought. And on that great last day, all human marriages will cease to be significant and will give way to the real thing when Christ returns for his beloved, his bride, his people. Engagement was taken very seriously in the Jewish culture, as it was as binding a commitment as marriage vows. And so for an engaged woman to flirt with another man in the time of her engagement was entirely inappropriate, very foolish, and very distressing for her father, as father of the bride. And that is the language that Paul uses to describe what's going on in Corinth. These folk whom he has betrothed to Jesus are flirting with novelty, which is very foolish and very disturbing for him as the matchmaker and the father of the bride. He had come earlier to Corinth with the good news of the gospel. And he said in 1 Corinthians 2, when I came to you, I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And they responded in faith, and a church was born, and there was a little group of people engaged to Jesus and waiting for his return. But life has moved on. Paul has been off elsewhere doing other things, and there are now new people in Corinth, new people in town, influential teachers who claim to be Christian, but have nothing good to say about Paul as the founder of the church. They're very critical of him in his absence, and they have largely won the Corinthians over to their side and to their way of seeing things. They have displaced the founder of the church and have brought something new and different. And they have two specific criticisms of Paul in his absence. For one thing, they say he's a wimp. He's weak and feeble. And we can get echoes of that in these chapters. So in verse 6, he talks rather surprisingly. He says, even if I'm unskilled in speaking, I am not so in knowledge. That is clearly an echo of their charge. They say that he was not very impressive as a speaker. Now, that may surprise us. We think of Paul as a very fine preacher. No doubt he was. He would have been captivating to listen to, superb advocate of the gospel of Christ. But he was not a fine speaker in their terms. That's the point. He didn't go in for cleverness. He didn't go in for rhetoric. He didn't go in for clever public speaking. And that didn't go down very well because the Greeks loved that. So you and I, if you want to spend an evening out, you might go out for a meal, you might go to the cinema, you might do whatever you like to do for an evening out. If you were in Corinth, you'd like to go and listen to somebody. Somebody would speak for an evening. And it honestly didn't matter what he spoke about. The content was irrelevant. What you were interested in was not what he said, but how he said it. And you'd come home saying, well, he was a brilliant speaker, wasn't he? And you'd talk about the superb way in which he could captivate an audience and all the rhetorical skills and so on. The content was neither here nor there. It was all fireworks from the front. And you would never have come home from listening to the Apostle Paul saying he was brilliant like that. He just didn't go in for it. He preached Christ and him crucified. So he's very unimpressive in that entertainment sense as a speaker. Very unimpressive, unskilled in speaking. He's weak and feeble. And doubtless to that basic accusation, they would add rumors of his ill health There are other indications in other letters that Paul was not always a very healthy man. He was not somebody to captivate by the impressive personality that he produced. He's a wimp, for one thing. And for another thing, he is just an amateur, they say. Just an amateur. He must be. And if you ask, well, how do you know? Surprisingly, he's an amateur, they say, because he doesn't charge for his services. He preached the gospel, verse 7, free of charge. And not only so, he says, I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. I refrained and will refrain from burdening you in any way, never charged for his services. Now again, that may surprise us. It seems rather an odd thing. To comment on. I mean, if you come into church, you don't expect probably to have to come with a ticket for which you paid £5 on a Sunday morning. It's just not how we do things. It's culturally very different. But you see, in Corinth, if you had a lot of money, what you would do with it? You'd sponsor a speaker. You'd find somebody you thought could be a very, very good and impressive speaker, and you'd become their patron, and you'd then fund their speaking. And of course, somebody you funded like that was then beholden to you and would never criticize you, because you're in some sense in control of what they had to say. So, as far as the sort of Corinthian people, Corinthian culture was concerned, the point was that if the speaker was free, he can't be any good. You get what you pay for. Well, we recognize that, don't we, in other spheres? I mean, many years ago I taught at what was briefly the most expensive school in England. Only briefly, but for a moment it just topped the charts in terms of the level of its fees. And the interesting thing was that when it did that, the requests for brochures doubled overnight, simply because it was the most expensive. The reason it was the most expensive is it had no reserves whatever. So it had to charge for everything, and a lot of independent schools have lots of money behind them. This particular school had none at all, so it became the most expensive. And everybody thought, because it's very expensive, it must be very, very good. It doesn't follow. But they transferred that kind of thinking to speaking. You see, if you have to pay a lot to listen to this guy, he must be good. If he's free, he can't be worth listening to. And Paul is determined that he brings a gospel which is of the free grace of God, and he's not going to charge for people listening. No, he makes it plain elsewhere that it's fine, it is right, it is appropriate for people in Christian ministry to be supported financially by others, which is just as well for some of us. He accepted cash from other churches, Macedonian churches, those generous Christian people from Macedonia we heard about earlier. He accepted money from them, but he wouldn't have it from the Corinthians, because in that case, it would be a kind of way of controlling him. And he wouldn't allow them to control him in any way by putting him under financial obligations to them. And so he's willing, even to use the strong language, and rob other churches in order to serve them free of charge. He would even work with his own hands if necessary. And that was the pit culturally. You didn't work with your own hands if you were anybody. You didn't get your hands dirty. Manual labor was despicable. Not if you're going to be a speaker. But Paul did it rather than have them pay for his upkeep. And so all this indicates he is just an amateur. He has to labor, he has to make tents to keep himself alive, say his critics. He can't charge for his services, he can't be worth listening to. He's a wimp, and he's an amateur wimp, and you should have nothing more to do with him. That is the line that these new folk take who have arrived. They, by contrast, are mega personalities, professional and powerful and slick, and the Corinthians buy everything that they say, even to the extent, as he says, of being willing to be made slaves of them, or have advantage taken of them, or even be struck in the face by these new people. It's just a price they're willing to pay because they think they're so impressive. Now, Paul is not happy at all that he has been displaced like this. He is not happy at all. It's very plain in the way he writes. And so we ask, why so? They prefer the newcomers to him. So is that just simple rivalry? Is it personal pique that other preachers are thought to be better than he is and he's miffed? Well, it would be understandable, wouldn't it? Competitiveness in Christian ministry is a very subtle snare and a common one, the desire to want to be thought to be the most spiritual, the best speaker, the best, most effective Christian leader, and so on, not liking it when somebody else is better spoken of. Christian ministers are not free of these sort of temptations at all. But Paul is far too big a man to be bothered by that kind of thing. That's not the issue at all. His actual fear, as he goes on to say in chapter 12, is that people may think too well of him. That's a very striking thought, isn't it? His fear is that somebody might think more of him than he actually deserves. That's not a very common fear, but it's certainly his. Now, his concern is not personal in that sense. It's that in rejecting him, these Corinthian Christians are rejecting Jesus. I'm afraid, he says in verse 3, that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes and proclaims another Jesus than the one we proclaimed, you put up with it readily enough. It wouldn't matter if it was just his reputation, but to reject Paul is to reject the gospel that he brought. And there's only one gospel which has the power to save for eternity. And that's why he is so bothered that they are giving way to a different teaching, that a different Jesus. He is father of the bride, and the bride is playing around with somebody else, a rival suitor, and he feels a divine jealousy, verse 2, for them, because he betrothed them to Christ. So much jealousy is ugly. We know jealousy is a very ugly thing. But there is a proper and a right jealousy. If a wife doesn't care about her husband's adultery, just shrugs her shoulders and say, well, you know, men will be men, there is something badly wrong. There is an appropriate jealousy. And Paul feels it for these folk. He's not possessive for his own sake. He'll gladly give this bride away to Jesus at the end. But he will not give them away to fakes. And these people who've arrived are fakes. They claim to be the real thing, but he says in verse 13, they are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. These new teachers then are bringing another Jesus, a one different one from the one Paul and the apostles proclaimed. In what sense is that Jesus, the new Jesus, different? Well, probably not doctrinally. They are probably quite likely orthodox, saying all the right things about the divinity of Christ and so on. That is an issue in other churches. It doesn't seem to be the issue here. No, it's much more a stylistic issue. Their Jesus, the Jesus they spoke of, was like them. Flashy, slick, impressive, triumphant, and all the things which are culturally very acceptable, because that's what you liked if you were in Corinth. You liked brash, flashy, impressive, triumphant people. And there Jesus is molded to fit with the culture. He's undergone a subtle change. And behind this new teaching, says Paul, is the activity of Satan himself that the Corinthians have bought into it. And clearly, they're not very impressed with him anymore. They don't want to listen to what he has to say. So that brings a question, doesn't it? How is he now going to get through to these wayward Corinthian Christians who've had enough of him? And he uses a surprising tactic. He decides to boast. He goes in for boasting. Now, we in the Western world, we don't much like boasting. Boastful people go down rather badly. People who just waltz in and list all their achievements to you and are clearly very proud and pleased with themselves. Culturally, they don't do it like that, do we? It's not specifically a Christian thing. Though, of course, the reason that we don't like that culturally is really the influence of the person of Christ on our culture over the generations, over the centuries. It is the meekness and gentleness of Christ which has given us in our culture our instinctive distaste for boasting. But in Corinth, you see, they loved it. They thought it was brilliant. Somebody turned up and said, look, listen to me. This is what I've done. I'm brilliant. I did this, that, I did that, the other. I was Lord Lieutenant of this. I won 5 Oscars. I've got 6 Nobel Prizes. Fantastic, they'd say. Really brilliant. They reveled in it. It went on very, very well. Boasting was brilliant. And so Paul says, okay, well, my turn. I'll have a go. If that's what you'll listen to, I'll give it a shot. Since lots of people boast of their achievements, including these new teachers, I'll do the same. Off we go. Yes, I'm talking like a madman, but I'll have a shot. These are the people you admire so much. He says, are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? Me too. So far, so good. Everybody on a level. And then verse 23, are they servants of Christ? So am I. In fact, I'm a better one. You think, hang on, that's a strange way to talk. What about the meekness and gentleness of Christ that we were hearing about earlier? Now, Paul said, I'm a better one. Listen to my achievements compared to those. I've planted churches all over the Roman world. They only exist because of me. I've preached in all the great meeting places, in all the great cities of that world. I've written brilliant theological treatises which will exercise the finest minds across the globe for the next 2,000 years and more. It's all true. But it's not what he says. It's not what he says. He boasts, but not the way they do. Instead, he lists his sufferings and the humiliations which have come his way as a laborer in God's harvest field. That's what he boasts in. He talks about the judicial punishments he's received at the hands of the Romans. Far more imprisonments. Countless beatings. Countless. There's so many of them been beaten up that he's lost count. Often near death. Then there is the ferocity he's experienced at the hands of Jewish authorities. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes less one, because you weren't meant to go above 39. 5 times. Then he was beaten with rods, which wasn't meant to happen to a Roman citizen like Paul. Fierce punishments to the Romans, ferocity from the Jews, and beaten up by a lynch mob. Once I was stoned. Then natural disasters, 3 shipwrecks. Acts only records 1. In fact, it's only this chapter which gives us a window into what Paul really did go through as an apostle and servant of Christ. 3 shipwrecks, adrift at sea for a night and a day, on frequent journeys, always on the road, always in danger from rivers, robbers, his own people, Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers. In toil and hardship, through many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure, living below the poverty line, without food and without shelter. These are my achievements, says Paul. And even in easier days, and there were easier days for him, there's his fatherly concern all the time for the churches he's planted, and for the problems they endlessly produce, like wayward children determined to make shipwreck of their own lives. Paul had no physical children of his own, but he knew all about the pains of parenting. Apart from other things, there was the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak, and I am not weak? That's me, says Paul. He accepts this charge of weakness, and in fact, he boasts in it. They boast in other things. He boasts in the things that show his weakness. Why then should the Corinthians listen to him rather than to the new teachers? And he gives 2 reasons. The first is because he loves them. He loves them. The newcomers are clearly dynamic and impressive, but they're not motivated by love. Whereas for Paul, he's already said, it is the love of Christ which controls us, that drives us on, because we are convinced that one has died for all, and therefore all have died. Do I not love you? He says, verse 11, God knows that I do. He is very warm-hearted and very vulnerable. He loves these Corinthian Christians. The newcomers just exploit their gullibility and treat them roughly. And strangely, they put up with it. They think it's the deal. They should listen to Paul because he loves them. And secondly, because his Jesus is the true Jesus. The newcomers offer another Jesus who is more acceptable to the culture of the day. A flashy, impressive, powerful Jesus went down well in Corinth, especially if proclaimed by flashy, impressive, powerful people. The trouble with that, Jesus, is you'd never have learnt from listening to these teachers that he was a man of sorrows, that he was familiar with grief, and you'd have been embarrassed by the way he died in weakness. There was not much vulnerability in these new preachers. They offered glory without a cross. And our culture has some similarities with Corinth, but even so, it's very, very different. And there are teachers around today, supposedly Christian, sometimes in public view, who likewise offer a subtly different Jesus, more acceptable to our culture in the UK in 2015. He's not a flashy and powerful one, probably, though he may be in some television programs and things. More likely, the new Jesus is the all-tolerant Jesus, the all-affirming Jesus, the inclusive Jesus, who would never say anyone else was wrong or any lifestyle unacceptable, the anti-discriminatory Jesus, the Jesus who is glad just to be all things to all people. It's very attractive to us culturally, the Jesus of tolerance and inclusiveness. It's very culturally acceptable, and it's false. It's teaching that comes from hell. And a Jesus like that will never call you to suffer for his sake, will never ask you to make painful choices out of faithfulness to him, will never ask you to stand out from the crowd or to swim against the tide. And the proof that Paul is the real thing, preaching the real Jesus, is seen in the hostility and the contempt that he receives from an unbelieving world. That's why he lists what it cost him to be a servant. He gladly accepts this accusation of weakness, of being a wimp, if you like, but he insists that his weakness, far from disqualifying him, is actually the badge of authenticity. If I must boast, he says in verse 30, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. By the way, he says, have you heard about my VC, my Victoria Cross? The Roman army had an equivalent to the Victoria Cross, which was called the Corona Muralis. It was the crown of the wall, and it was awarded to the first soldier who had managed to climb the wall of a besieged city. The first one in got the VC, the Corona Muralis, the CM. Well, Paul says, have you heard about mine? I wasn't the first to go up it as a hero. I was actually let down secretly in a basket and ran away. I was let down in a basket and escaped. That's my heroics. I didn't get the crown. I got the wooden spoon. Because weakness is the name of the game. Christ was crucified in weakness. But, says Paul, he lives by the power of God.